recording.
All right. I'm a little bit frustrated because there is so much more to say, and we only have one more session. So we're going to have to cut things, which I guess is good. This means that, Yoter, as the Kohen Gadol used to say, Yoter mima shekarati katuv kan. Last week we really sort of surveyed, broadly the rise of Islam, and here and there went off into more direct question about where Jews fit into all of this and Judaism. I want to do three things. A, I want to outline exactly what the ideal role of Jews in the Islamic polity is. Number one. Number two, I want to talk about how halacha and how Jewish tradition viewed Islam, at least through the eyes of the Rambam. And number three, I'm going to try to give an answer to a question which may or may not have occurred to you, but it really is something of a conundrum. How is it that the leaders in classical anti-Semitism, anti-Judaism today are Muslims and not Christians? So those are the three things. I hope we can get to all of them. Number one, there is a fundamental difference between Christianity and Judaism and Islam and Judaism, and it makes a very big difference in terms of how Jews are perceived. As we saw, the question of the continued existence of Judaism in its original state and Jewish people was a built-in problem, remains a built-in problem for Christendom, because ultimately, with some exceptions, Christianity is supersessionist, meaning that Christianity takes the place of Judaism, therefore Jews should leave. How you get around that, we talked about that. There are now churches which are less supersessionist. The Catholic Church has come a long way, I won't say in doing tshuva, but in terms of sort of modifying its supersessionism. It still says that the best way to get salvation is through faith in Jesus, and all kinds of Jewish intellectuals get crazy over that. I can't get upset. Like, why? That's what they believe. I'm not going to go ask them to change their beliefs. That's what they believe. Or like, it reminds me of my students. I don't know if I told you that we were once talking about the evangelical support of Israel, and a bunch of the students get all really alta hits, and they start saying, but if they think if they give the money that Jesus is going to come and it's going to bring Jesus back. You know what? When Jesus comes back, I'll worry about it. In the meantime, the money's fungible and the support is important. I can't get worked up about this. A certain amount of respect towards the belief of somebody else, even if you disagree or think he's wrong, I think is in place. In fact, I'm going to put in a, I don't know if I should, because he's sort of like above the fray. There was a conference going on this past week at, I think it's the Van Leer, and the Mishkanot Shananim, on the question of violence in the name of God. And the keynote speaker was Lord Rabbi Sachs. And he's always agonizing, how is it possible that people can do violence in the name of God? I don't know what discussions of that do for us. I mean, it's possible people go to extremes. I think the historians, for nothing, approach go and say, look, it's an historical fact, and we have to deal with it and accept that people of principle can be brought to do all kinds of things, which are really not sympathy at best, in the name of God. You know, so, and how do you deal with it? And how do you deal with that on the ground? I don't think trying to explain it and to say, make myself feel better because they're bad, I don't see how that gets you anywhere. All right, anyways. But so Christianity has a built-in Jewish problem, and you need Augustine, and you need privileges and all kinds of things to be able to adjudicate it. Islam has no such problem. From the very beginning, as far on the question, even though Islam is fundamentally supersessionist, and Muhammad is the seal of all the prophets, and the Quran is the most important, is the final revelation, all of that being true, in their opinion, nevertheless, there was never a, Muhammad himself already built into the system the possibility that people who are not Muslims can live in the Dar al-Islam. First of all, he was fundamentally from the beginning quoted, the Quran says, I mean, Allah in his opinion, or historically Muhammad, that there is not, you can't force a person of religion to convert under coercion. Famous expression, la ikhafil din, there is no coercion in religion. If I take a gun and put it to your head and say, do you believe in whatever it is, you'll say yes, but you mean you believe in the bullet that's sitting in the chamber and not in whatever they're trying to convince you. On another occasion, he sort of, I think he's addressing Jews, if I remember correctly. He says, "Lakum dinukum walidini. I have my religion, you have your religion, I have my religion. We have a religion, and therefore I can live with you in my mitzvah." We'll get to this. Hold on. Now,
even if it's not monotheism?
Okay. That approach is predicated on one assumption. And that is that in the historiographic tradition, the way that Muhammad talks about the chain of revelation, there were three prior revelations before Muhammad. One was to Ibrahim and Musa and the Banu Israel, and that ended up, and that was inscribed in the Torah. The second one is to Isa ibn Maryum, the prophet, and that's in the New Testament. And then there is the third to the prophet Zoroaster in Persia in his writings. All of those, let's assume they're no longer applicable, or their dates have expired, okay? And now comes the new one. All of those are unique in the fact that they maintain the belief in one God, who exists outside of history, created the world, and provided those who believe in him with a record of that revelation. Now, Mazdaism, Zoroaster is kind of funny because Zoroastrianism actually is a dualistic religion. There's Ahura Mazda, that's the good God, and there's Ahriman, who's the bad God. By the time of Muhammad, it appears that Ahriman had taken a second step to Ahura Mazda, and therefore one could argue that there was a good God and a Satan. That's already another story. In fact, if you look, there's a, this is sort of blew me away. Durov, who's my neighbor, has published his books in German with Ahriman Press. And I say, Ahriman, isn't it Ahriman? Ahriman is Ahriman. There's a press in Germany which is named after the bad god or the devil in, whatever. You see a picture of this, like, diabolic figure, and that's who it is. Now, Satan exists in all these religions and so on and so on. In any event. So all those three. If you do not have a religion, if you are not an alal kitab, a people of the book, and that's where the expression starts, meaning you believe in one God and you have a revelation, then those are the people to whom the choice is given between Islam and death. There is no place in the Muslim polity for a person who is a polytheist, for a person who is a idolater, for a person who does not have a revelation from the one God. Now, in most cases, pagans converted. First of all, pagans are more tolerant. Anyways, and number two, paganism was pretty much very much on the decline by the time Islam broke out of the Arabian Peninsula. That became a real issue, a greater issue, when Muslims conquered India. Because India is there's an argument today between scholars. Is it monotheistic, non-monotheistic? There are two major books coming out. One's arguing that it's not a Vodazara. The other says it is a Vodazara. It's not important. As far as the Muslims are concerned, with all of the idols and with all of the statues and with all of the gods, this was a Vodazara. All of the Vodazara have no right to live. They can either convert or they can die or they can be condemned to slavery, which is just an extended death. And the ugly secret of Indian history is the ongoing massacres and subjection and subjugation of Hindus and Buddhists and Jain and everyone under Muslim rule. Until at some point the Muslims realized that like, you can't kill them all. So some kind of an arrangement was sort of made under the Mughals, which is sort of a timeout. But if you ask Hindus about Muslims, you'll get an earful. It wasn't for nothing that they had to divide, that they had to, yesterday was 29th of November, that in 1947 they had to partition India. And to this day, if a Pakistani Muslim wants to move back to India and reclaim his property and come back to India, he is subject to, technically at least, subject to the death penalty. It's not a happenstance that most of the violence within India, it takes place between Muslims and Christians to this day. And the first target is always either the Hindu temple or the mosque. If you're not a monotheist and you don't have, you're not part of one of these three other traditions, then you have a very serious situation. Yeah.
Subject to the death penalty from the Hindu.
Hindus. Hindus. Okay, now, Christians, Jews, and Mazdians. Mazdians, you have to understand, the Mazdian religion of Zoroaster, or Zarathustra, was the state religion of the Persian Empire. In fact, there's a Hanukkah sect connection with this because they worshipped fire. And the Gemara tells us that, in fact, one of the initial reason for hiding Hanukkah lights and not putting them in the window is because of Amgushi. The Magi, remember? Magi, gift of the Magi. The Magi were the priests of Ahura Mazda, and the ritual use of fire for a non-Mazdian religion was persecuted at certain times, and therefore that was the first time that the heter was to allow you to light your candles in the house. Later on, it became a business with the Christians, but that was the original background. So it was in their interest to try to make some kind of an accommodation with the Mazdians. By the way, one of the most famous Mazdians in the world is associated with us. Anybody know who?
Zubin
Mehta. Zubin Mehta is a Mazdian. He's born in India because ultimately the Muslims ran them out of Persia. But he's, you know, all originally it's a Persian religion. Okay. Muhammad, this idea that people that are members of Ahlul Kitab can have a place within the Muslim polity, finds expression very, very early on. When, as part of the move, as part of the hijrah from Mecca to Medina in 622, Muhammad offered what was called the covenant or the constitution of Medina, in which he said all people who are not, that first of all, that, you know, wanted everybody to convert to Islam. If you don't convert to Islam, Jews, in particular, we saw were major players in Medina. If they don't, then they are allowed to live on condition that they pay extra taxes and that they give up any kind of equality. So in other words, what we're going to see in a second in the Pact of Omar, is in fact rooted in the constitution of Al-Medina, which was formulated by the Prophet. Now the text we're going to look at together is it's not clear when it was written. There are those who attribute, it's called the Pact of Umar. It's not clear which Umar. There was, the first caliph was Abu Bakr. By the way, the head of Daesh, the head of ISIS, his name Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. That's not his name, but he adopted that name because that to hark back to the first caliph, Abu Bakr. The second caliph was Umar ibn al-Khattab, who conquered Jerusalem. Excuse me. So there are those who say that he's the one who dictated this. There are those who say that in the present form, it was actually dictated by Umar II in 722. It doesn't matter. It's all rooted. No, it's interesting. We don't have one about the Jews. We have one about the Christians.
Yeah.
But it's the same. The rules are the same. The rules are the same. So this is the text. We heard from Abdurrahman ibn Ghanim as follows. When Umar ibn al-Khattab, may God be pleased with him, by the way, square, when you walk into Shar Yafo, that square is called the square, Kikar Umar ibn al-Khattab. If you take look on the left, by the way, two graves right behind the thing. Those are the two architects who built the walls for Suleiman the Magnificent, but they forgot to keep bring Hartzion in the thing, so he left. Anyway. He quoted the piece to the Christians of Syria, who wrote to him as follows. According to the way that this is reported, these are the conditions of surrender that the Christians of Ilia Capitolina proposed to the Muslims when they came in 637 to conquer Jerusalem. I kind of doubt. Usually, those who conquer do not suggest the terms of submission. This, I suspect, is an offer that they couldn't refuse. In the name of God, the merciful and compassionate, it's a letter of the servant of God, Umar ibn al-Khattab, commander of the faithful. That's the title of the caliph. From the Christians of such and such a city, it's Ilia. When you came against us, we asked you for safe conduct for ourselves, our descendants, our property, the people, our community, and we undertook the following obligation towards you. In other words, we want to have our lives, our property, and our religious rights secured, and this is the price that we will pay to do that, or the price that was suggested that they should pay. We will not build in our cities or in their neighborhood new monasteries, churches, convents, or monk cells, nor shall we repair by day or by night such of them as fall in ruins or situated in the quarters of the Muslims. The coming of Islam means freezing the status quo. All churches, all synagogues, all Batei Midrash, all monasteries that are standing may stand. New ones not, because now is the time for the new dispensation.
Okay. Yeah, but it also says that there are
fair. Right. Technically that's true. By the way, technically you're not supposed to repair a shul in Christendom either. But here there was more wiggle room. But, in general, new ones not. We're going to come to it a little later, but I might as well, as long as I'm thinking about it now. When they built the Churva, you have to understand, building buildings are statements. How you build the building, where you build the building, is a statement.
Oh, yeah.
Okay? The shul, according to Halacha, is supposed to be the tallest building in town. Okay? Similarly, the church is the tallest building in town. That's one of the reasons you have a spire. And the mosque is to be the tallest building in town. That's why they have the minarets, whatever. That is the reason why, okay? When they rebuilt the Churva, there were riots claiming that the Al-Aqsa is in danger. Not because it was physical, well, maybe they might have been playing on ignorance that they thought the Al-Aqsa was really in danger, but symbolically, the Rova is taller than Har HaBayit, and the Churva is taller. By the way, Anachnu lo nishavim chayavim, that's the reason why Heichal Shlomo was built in the tallest hill in Yerushalayim. And the Beit Knesset HaGadol is even taller than that, to stick it back. You get the point? Like, this keeps going. This is architectural one-upsmanship, because symbols are critical. Symbols say what you cannot say in words. They embody. Okay? That's the reason why people thought they were crazy. When they built the Capitol in Washington, you ever try to walk up the steps of the Capitol? They're like, because the idea was that it was to project power at the time that it was a two-bit country. You build to project your ideas. That's why the Knesset's on a hill. All of these things are very, very critical. So the same thing over here. We will not build. All right, we have a place, but we can't grow. That's a statement. Okay? And symbols are very... I mean, in the modern era, symbols, like words, become deracinated and cheapened. But up until the postmodern internet world, symbols are really, really, really important. Because again, they say far more than words can ever do. We shall keep.
I beg to differ, because I think that with settlements all the time, an obstacle to peace, obstacle. So it's the excuse for any act of terror.
That's true.
People are building houses.
Right.
It is a statement. So yes, everything is cheapened by the words that people use the day out on the stupid internet. But on the other hand.
Okay, so that's true. That's true.
So let
me take it one step further. That's true. That's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. That the actions still speak louder than words, and they're still symbolic. Don't forget, the Arab world, the Islamic world, is not postmodern. They still respect the word. They still respect the written word. They still respect symbols. They're very, very, very important. To that degree, I think our society outside of Rehov Shaken is still very much not postmodern in that regard, because symbols are still important. Yes, you're right. We shall keep our gates wide open for passers-by and travelers. We shall give board and lodging to all Muslims who pass our way for 3 days. That's a sign of whatever. We shall not give shelter in our churches or in dwellings to any spy or bid him from the Muslims. Don't forget, the Jews were politically, irrelevant in terms of that, but don't forget that the Christians are still the other, superpower. So there's always the Christians are always being suspected of being a fifth column. We shall not teach the Quran to our children on assumption that this is not for purposes of conversion. But a non-Muslim touching the Quran is a business. Islam, especially Shiites, are heavily in Tum and Tahara. And therefore, for a kafir, for a non-believer to touch a Quran is an anathema. And Muslims wash and do all kinds of ablutions before prayer and after prayer, whatever, far more than Jews do. So to have a, to have a non-believer. For example, according to some, if a Muslim shakes hands with a non-Muslim, then he has to wash before he can do anything, the Davar Sheva Kedusha, because non-Jews are also Matame. But not to that degree, but it's a serious business. But that's important, because you have to realize that when you live in a world of where Tum and Tahara are living religious, I remember a whole book about this, living religious realities, then they become formative in the way you look at the world and other people. It's not stam. Now we shall not manifest our religion publicly nor convert anyone to it. It is prohibited to convert somebody to convert Muslims to Judaism and Christianity. They don't really care if Christians become Jews or Jews become Christians, but no. We shall not prevent any of our kin from entering Islam if they wish it, which you can imagine. Manifestation of religion publicly pops up later. Skip down. We shall not display our crosses or our books on the roads or the markets of the Muslims. We shall use only clappers in our churches very softly. We shall not raise our voices when following our dead. We shall not show lights on any of the roads on the Muslims or in their markets. We shall not bury our dead near the Muslims.
Clappers
are two pieces of wood banging together. Okay? So, religions are non-Muslim religions are not, can, must be not seen and not heard. Okay? Therefore, okay, as a result, to this day, in the Armenian quarter, when the Armenians call the faithful to church, they bang two pieces of wood together, in accordance with Amanat Omar. Because to do more than that would be a sign of being uppity, would be a sign of being manifest outside, I mean, a sign of dignity, a sign of honor. There were no church bells in Jerusalem till the British walked in 1917. Okay.
Isn't that interesting, given the current Muslim?
Yeah. So you're not all, okay. And by the way, there are consistent descriptions of shul. I mean, I saw it myself. That shuls and in general Jewish homes from the outside look like nothing, look like hovels, and you walk in, they have these amazing things. I'll never forget about
the ghetto in Venice.
Okay.
The only way you know
right.
is there are five arches.
Correct. But here the Christians and the Muslims are in the same. I want to talk about, but I want, let me tell you something about the Islamic line. When I was in France, one of the times I was in France, whenever it was, about 10, 15 years ago, we were spending Shabbos with a friend who's a professor at the Sorbonne, now commutes from Tveria, actually talk about commuting. And we went to the only Ashkenazi shul, I think it was left in his arrondissement. But on the way home, he took me to a Tunisian shul. And you go in, he says, here's the shul. I say, I see a blank wall with a little door. So we went in this little iron door where there was a cop in front. That was how you knew it was a shul. You went up this stairwell. On the second floor, at the far end, again, double doors. And then you go into this incredibly elaborate with a, you know, it's a Sephardi shul. So it has a dome and it's got marble and whatever. So I said, why is this? Because that's the way they had in Tripoli. You couldn't have any sign whatsoever that this was a shul. Inside, you could do whatever you want. So they invested and made the shul beautiful. But from the outside, klapei chutz, absolutely nothing. You're not allowed, la'arim et harosh. You're not allowed to raise your profile, literally or figuratively, or else that is disrespect towards Islam.
Also, you have this thing about the saddle.
We're gonna get to that.
That was transportation.
We shall show respect toward the Muslims and shall rise at our seats when they sit. To this day, there are places in the Arab world, the Muslim world, where Jews are not allowed to live, is walk in the sidewalk, or they have to give way to Muslims. We shall not seek to resemble the Muslims by imitating any of their garments, the kalanswa, the turban, footwear, or so on, or the parting of the hair. We shall not speak as they do, nor we adopt their kunyas. We shall not mount on saddles, nor shall we gird swords or bear arms of any kind, nor carry them on our persons. Okay, well, what's that? First of all, Jews and Christians are not allowed to bear arms anyways. Okay, as we'll see, the deal is we will protect you, and you don't bear arms, you keep these terms. That's the deal. That's called being under protection, actually. Chasut in Arabic, the dhimma. And if you are under this kind of protection, then you are dhimmi. You are protected minorities. You don't go on a horse because a horse is like a tank. A horse is a vehicle of war. Okay, that's not what? Okay, right. That's number one. Number two, there's something deeper than that. Bernard Lewis, in a long article that he published many, a number of years ago, makes the following point. I think it's well taken. But in order to understand that, we have to skip down a little bit. We shall always dress in the same way, wherever be, and we shall bind the zunar around our waist. The zunar is like a big belt. It was the Muslims who invented the idea that minorities should be distinguished by clothing. Christians traditionally wore red, and Jews traditionally wore yellow. That idea of distinguishing minorities to prevent socializing and so on was adopted by the Christians from the Muslims, and enacted for the first time in law in 1215 at the Fourth Lateran Council in Rome by Pope Innocent III. The last thing he was, from our point of view, was Innocent, but he was a great pope. That's why it was ironic when Ahmadinejad wanted to impose this on the Jews and Christians of Iran. They're all screaming Holocaust, when in fact all he was doing was Marzir Atara Lyoshna, in that regard. What's the point? I'm sorry? No, maybe. The question why red, I've never heard a really good explanation by the red. The yellow, I know. Why Jews and yellow? Why Jews with yellow? Because traditional Arab society is extremely misogynist, and it's extremely patriarchal, and it's extremely hierarchical. At the bottom of the food chain are three groups. There are slaves, there are dhimmi, and there are women. Okay, that there, mamish, the bottom. The slaves are obviously at the bottom. One thing that slaves and women have in common, though, is the fact that, at least till recently, slaves can't make themselves not slaves, and women can't make themselves not women. So they're like stuck. Dhimmi are like worse than both of them, because they could actually get out of their situation in a second by going to a shari court and saying shahada three times and goodbye and barakah ba. Okay, or assalamu alaikum, or whatever they would say. Alright? That's point number one you have to keep in mind. So among the worst, among the bottom of the barrel, the worst of the bottom of the barrel are the dhimmi. In addition, if there is a group who really is held in contempt in traditional, Arab society, it's women. At the bottom of the group of women are women who sell by the hour, or rent by the hour, and they wear yellow. Okay? So for a Jew to wear yellow is to say that he is together at the bottom of the barrel with the lowest of the women. And in a macho society which is heavily, heavily militant in its self-image, the woman is the categoric opposite of the Arab warrior and so on. So by taking away weapons, it's not just a matter of that's the deal. It's a statement about the nature, at least, of the Jew as dhimmi, that they're not to be taken seriously. They're a bunch of women. They're a joke. In traditional Arabic, and prostitutes also be tossed away, whatever. So in an oral society, images float in and out. I mean, there's not clear delineation, but you sort of like the same kind of emotional response towards the group. Jews are held in contempt in traditional Arabic literature, for example. According to some legends, they couldn't even bother. They tried to crucify Jesus, they couldn't even do that. I mean, there's something wrong with them. They're not to be taken seriously at all. They're held in contempt. They make money. They're cheap. They're little crooks. They cheat a little bit. You know, that's what they do. They're not to be taken seriously. We will come back to that. But that's a very, very heavily important piece. That it's not just that we protect them, that they really can't take care of themselves. Christians, on the other hand, had a little bit, I'm not saying it was a Gan Eden, because all you have to do is talk to Christians who lived under Muslims to hear the stories. But, in a sense, Christians were perceived with a little lot more respect because the Muslims had themselves beaten, and beaten badly, by Christians. whether it's in the Crusades. Look at the trauma of the Crusades. Still is a major issue in Arab self-definition. When, he backtracked, but when Bush said that he was going to go on a crusade against the Taliban, that he didn't realize, I don't think he realized just how resonant that was in the Arab world. Okay. We don't need to, we can skip down a little bit. When I brought the letter to Umar, may God be pleased with him, he added, we will not strike a Muslim. Okay, for obvious reasons. We accept these conditions for ourselves and the people of our community. In return, we receive safe conduct. If we in any way violate these undertakings, for which we ourselves stand surety, we forfeit our covenant, and we become liable to the penalties for contumacy and sedition. In other words, if we don't play by the rules, we're not protected, and therefore you can do with us as you wish. And that was never sympathetic. Okay?
What is contumacy?
Stubbornness, rebelliousness. Now, at the end of the day, with huge variations, okay, this is the formative document for determining the proper state of Jews within the Dar al-Islam. Again, sometimes it was enforced more, and sometimes it was enforced less. And I mean, yes, and that's absolutely true. But at the end of the day, this document set the outside parameters for what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. And in fact, more or less within over the past 1,350 years, the Muslims pretty much kept to this arrangement. If you play by the rules, you'll be okay. If not, not. In general, you can find. Okay, and I'm going to warn you. Part three come now, and we'll come back to the Jews in a little bit. Generally, those pogroms that were visited upon Jews were, in one way or another, connected to Jews not playing by the rules. So, for example, the famous pogrom in 1066, in which Jews were by the hundreds were killed and the Jews were thrown out of Granada in Spain, was because the son of Shmuel HaNagid decided that he didn't want to play the schlepper anymore. He decided to act and to externalize his status as the wazir of Granada, and that was all it took, and whatever. His father knew how to play the gornisht, when in fact he really was the commander of the host. You had to know how to walk between the drops. And in fact, even in Spain, and there was no golden age in Spain, at least not the way they like to describe it, even the great figures, courtiers of the golden age in Spain, like Chasda ibn Chaprut and Shmuel and Agid and the members of the Al-Baliya family and of the Ibn Ezra family, knew how to exactly, you know, be humble and obsequious and unctuous and whatever and not get caught in this regard. But it was always a very, very iffy business. There are exceptions. The wholesale persecution of Jews of Meshed in Iran in the 19th century, which all the Jews of Meshed were forced to go convert to Islam. Many of the Jews, in fact, the Parsi Jews on Long Island of Meshed, they all sort of ran away as soon as they possibly could. That's sort of unusual. You have movements within Islam, which, for however they do it, do not play by these rules. So in the time of the Rambam, you had the Almohadim from North Africa, who actually forced Islam on everybody. In North Africa, everybody under their rule. ISIS apparently works by similar rules. Why and how? You can argue they don't play by the rules, they have arms, they have this, they have all kinds of stuff. But you do have exceptions. At the end of the day, it's not that surprising if you understand that the prime directive is conquest, and that Allah's word is the only way to go, or as the bumper sticker says, Islam is the way, then you can easily, maybe if you try to get in somebody's head like that, you can understand why it'd be easy to, like, let the brakes go and just go full speed. I'm not justifying it, and many, many Muslim scholars say that that's not appropriate. But it's not, to say it's not Islam is ridiculous. It's not rooted in, it's rooted in the same place and has different valences. I think it's the most disrespectful thing in the world for Christians and Jews to sit there and say, that's not Islam. Who are you? It just doesn't go. All right, anyways. This image of the Jew, rooted, the woman, this, he's not masculine, he's a small-time thief, whatever, is very, 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 very deeply embedded in Arabic literature as well, and so an image. And the Jews played their game, so, you know, you're being subservient. I mean, how did you used to pay the jizya? Well, according to many, one of the things that the members of the, that the dhimmi had to do was pay poll tax. Now, what's a poll tax? A poll tax is a tax justifying your existence. It's incredibly degrading, and it's very, very expensive. By the way, the two famous poll taxes that I can think of, first of all, there were poll taxes that were levied on black sharecroppers in the 19th century after emancipation in order to prevent them from voting. Okay? Margaret Thatcher wanted to impose a poll tax in England, and there were riots. Because it's humiliating, and the way that you were technically supposed to pay it is even more humiliating. You're never supposed to, for example, look a Muslim in the eye. Ever. That would show equality. So how would you pay the poll tax? You would put the money in your hand, you would walk in like this, and then you would walk back like this, without ever looking the Muslim in the eye. Okay, that was absolutely, unacceptable. And there were all kinds of other restrictions like that as well. There were property taxes and other things which only dhimmi had to pay, because they ultimately paid for their own protection. That was the idea. By the way, their total dependency was one of the things that made them attractive as secretaries and as doctors, because at the end of the day, you could do with them as you wish, because you say, you violated them, or goodbye. All of which raises the question of, how do we get from there to the fact that the Protocols of the Elders of Zion is a bestseller in Arabic? How do we get from there to these horrific horrific images you find on the net? I'm just going to show you one which is pretty. Here, let me pass that around. How do you get from that to this? There's a picture of a Jew with a big nose and terrible teeth licking the Dome of the Rock like an ice cream cone. And there are others of beating babies and stuff like that. Where's all that come from? So this is not my original research, but I'm referring to a book which I think there were two books I think every Jew should read. I mean, a lot of books every Jew should read, but on the issue of anti-Semitism, one book is called The Devil and the Jews by Joshua Trachtenberg, but you should buy the later edition with Mark Sapper's introduction, which puts it into context. More importantly, for those of us living in the Middle East, the book is called Semites and Anti-Semites by Bernard Lewis. It's a history of anti-Semitism and then trying to understand what led to this phenomenon. Lewis makes the following observation. He asked the question that I just asked. How did we get from the Jew as a joke to Jew as a diabolical, dangerous world peace? And the answer apparently is like this. First of all, with the arrival of the colonial powers in North Africa and in the Arab world, Jews stopped playing by the rules because they became supported by the European powers. That's a violation of the dhimma by definition. It's number one. So that's across the board. Number two. Zionism, by definition, is a dilation of the dhimma. Because, A, we're settling in Dar al-Islam land. B, aspire to, you know, rule. And C, defend themselves. Now, that's a violation of the dhimma. It's also a violation of the image of the Jew. Okay? Or as a friend of mine who is a Upper West Side New York intellectual, Jews, guns, how does that work together? So if he can't figure it out, never mind here. Okay? What happened, so it's against that background that the Muftis, Yimach Shemo, started up with in 1920, Al-Aqsa is in danger. 1920. I mean, it's a bizarre charge because certainly at that time it was never even thought about. But it's also symbolic because what Al-Aqsa symbolizes is endangered by, and doesn't matter if they're going to blow it up or not, because the idea being that Jews endanger the proper order, which was ordained by Allah. You have to understand that. We are living blasphemers in that regard. Okay? It's not just a game. The idea that Jews will not fight, that it will not be a war to conquer Palestine in 1948, it will be a parade. It's not just propaganda. It's not just convincing yourself of your own military greatness. You have a very serious tradition of the Jew as a vimy, as this little, you know, non-threatening vimy. Jews don't fight. Now there were those who warned the Arab leaders that Jews fight, but it just didn't compute. That's the reason also why there was no peace in 1949. First of all, because you can't make over Dar al-Islam land to Kafir. And second of all, because it just didn't go together. That's the reason why in 1956, during the Sinai campaign, that's why it was a ceasefire. Ceasefire, Hudna we have. We talked about Hudna last week. In 1956, they blamed the British and the French. It wasn't the Jews who conquered Sinai, it was the British and the French. Also, the idea that the Crusaders, that they could conquer, this was something which they could deal with. But Jews? And that's why 67 was such a shock. And that's why they tried to blame the destruction of the Arab air forces initially on the Americans. Not, because it's just not possible. And the defeat was for everybody to see. I mean, you couldn't hide it. You couldn't say it was a Hudna. You couldn't say it was anything. You know, the Arab armies ran back over the canal. We swept in. We could have crossed the Jordan and taken Jordan too. We could have crossed the other. It was just too obvious. That raised a serious, not just military, not just political problem, a theological problem. Now, it is true. Up until 67, there were actually ex-Nazi propagandists who were working for the Arabs and were trying to, and were introducing classic anti-Semitic motifs and tropes and pictures into the press and into dialogue. But 67 was a real watershed. And the question was, is it possible that the forces of the believers were defeated by Jews? It's not possible that Allah wanted that. In other words, we have a whole tradition of the Nechatayna. We're so, look at it. We are, if things go wrong, we are really, you know, Cheshbon HaNefesh. We're like the ultimate. We have no problem. We can never deal with success. Disaster, we are just phenomenal. Notice that everybody knows what to do on Yom HaZikaron. Nobody to this day knows what to do on Yom HaAtzma'ut. I mean, yeah, okay, so we mangle. Okay, but you don't really need to work hard to convince any Israeli lasos alayish. I mean, that's like the default. I mean, when I was in the police, that's what you did in between mishmarot. You made alayish. So it wasn't, it was just, that's the way you do. So it's really striking. Okay, the fact that we're still with the plastic hammers and the spray, says something about the nature of the beast. In any event, the Arabs don't have that. Islam does not really have a very strong tradition of that kind of Dainzar Fault bin Mechatainu Galini Martsainu. So it can't be Allah. So a lot of theologians said, well, if it's not Allah, it must be the Shaitun. Satan. The Shaitun has a very, very pungent role in Muslim theology and, in more importantly, in Muslim folklore. Part of the Hajj is the stoning of the Shaitun. You go to a certain part, place south of Mecca, and you throw rocks at the Shaitun. But the minute you make that shidduch, that there was a between Jew and Satan, you open up the gates to absorb wholesale the entire Christian anti-Jewish tradition, which is predicated ultimately on that combination. And over the course of the, the diabolization of Israel, all of this, by the way, that makes it more, you know, you can sell it among anti-Semites in Europe too this way. It takes time to, absorb and to be domesticated. But over time, that's what happened. So a lot of this classic tropes of you have horrible pictures from the early 2000s of Sharon eating babies, and I mean some of it is like bizarre, some of it's really bizarre. There was an entire Hezbollah did an entire mini about the blood libel in which they showed Jews slaughtering Muslim babies to put their blood into matzahs, which makes no sense in a Muslim context. In a Christian context, it makes every sense. The Jew is the devil, and the Jew wants to salvation, but doesn't want salvation, so he does it in a perverse way by taking innocent Christian kids and putting the blood in the matzahs the same. But instead of just going to church and getting a sanctified wafer, which becomes it's Christianity upside down. But in Islam, it makes no sense. But it was absorbed anyway. Sometimes it gets to be really bizarre. Almost elegant if weren't so stupid. There was a professor at the University of Riyadh a number of years ago who claimed that the Jews don't kill Muslim kids to put blood in matzahs, they do it to put blood into hamantaschen. Now, whoa. Okay, now that, everybody laughed, and I said, that's goyness. That really was brilliant. Why? Because there is one theology, according to one line of thought, you know how psychologists say that, like, our kids are born fine and then we screw them up by the age of 2 or 3 and then, you know, but in other words, by the time we know what they're thinking, it's all over and then we start paying for the therapist. So the same thing is true according to some Muslim lines of Muslim theology. Every child in the world is born Muslim. And he's screwed up by his parents if he's born into a Christian or a non-Muslim family. Based on that logic, by the way, you ever heard of the Janissaries?
No.
The Janissaries were slave-military order in the Ottoman Empire that became ultimately very, very powerful. What the Ottomans would do, they would go into the Balkans and they would round up, kidnap, enlist, whatever they would do, little Christian kids. Force and convert them to Islam, and then they would raise them separately as soldiers, and they were the shock troops, the most loyal troops of the Ottoman Sultan. What was the logic? There's no convention. No, the children are born Muslim. It's only after they're screwed up and they become adults that you can't convert them. But now it's like a lahav de la gir cotton. So similarly, if that's the case, someone can argue that the Persians are, you know, Persians were all Muslims, and that we put blood in the hamantaschen to celebrate our, you know, victory over Haman and all of the Persian Muslims. Lest you think I'm out of my mind, I was telling this to a class a number of years ago. Everybody was born in Islam before, a fundamental, perfect, whatever, and they got messed up. Yes. Right. That's one line of argument. A number of years ago, I made this point in a class, and a student who was actually behaving, he wasn't paying attention, but he reading the paper, but at least he wasn't making noise. This is university students, right? He turned red, and then blue, and then white. I said, "What's the matter?" He says, "What you said is in the paper." I said, "What are you talking about?" That day, whatever paper, well, I think Maariv was still in print, so I don't know what paper it was. On the last page of whatever the newspaper was, it was announced that Ahmadinejad, who was still president of Iran, was removing the security detail from the putative grave of Mordechai and Esther in Iran. Why? He says, on the one hand, it's a religious site, and we, of course, respect all religions. However, he couldn't see using public funds to secure the grave of people who were responsible for the 50,000 Persian Iranian Muslims. Now, the story of Mordechai and Esther is dated to the 5th century BCE. So that tells you about, you know, that tells you something. But the point is that, coming back, so that ultimately, the theological hook that allowed for the absorption of, I mean, as I said, it was there before, but the wholesale absorption, internalization of all of the worst, most grotesque elements of the Christian anti-Jewish tradition is in fact the fact that they could not figure out, that they had to attribute Jewish success to the Shaitun, and once you do that, it's all, everything, you know, all, everything, all bets are off. Okay. That's, there's a lot more to say about this, but at least it'll give you an idea. But how can, so when they sit there and say, oh, we can't be anti-Semites, we're Semites, let me just make one comment about that. When anti-Semitism was invented in the late 18th, early 19th century, it was invented because Jews were assimilating and were converting en masse, and Europe discovered they didn't want them anyways. So the question is, they always said, just convert, you'll be fine. So I was against the desire not to absorb Jews and give emancipation, emancipated rights to Jews, that the idea became that being Jewish is not a matter of religion or of tribal affiliation, it's a matter of race. And racial studies were actually growing at the time. When they talked about race, when they talked about Semitism as something bad, which are against anti-Semitism, nobody thought about Muslims. Arabs weren't on the radar. Nobody thought about them. Are you there? He talks about the shkufim, the people you don't see. Even colonial, you know, Britons and whatever, they didn't see the Arabs either. As far as they were concerned, Semites are Jews. In fact, one of the great ironies of history is that Semitic studies was started by, and studies of Arab culture was started by Jews. In order to show that Semites don't need to be the way that you say Semites are, because here are the, I mean, it's just to say we accept your definition of what we are, but look at the Arabs, they can fight, and they can this, and they can, it's sort of like very, whatever. But the founders of Arabic studies, universities were all Jews, largely Jews. Ignaz Goldseer, the famous Hungarian Orientalist, is probably the best example, but not just. Okay. That's as far as this part is concerned. What about the Jews? Islam presented far less of a problem for halacha than did Christianity. Christianity had inherent pagan idolatrous, but about Avodah Zarah elements to it. Islam from day one was, self-defined as monotheistic in the most extreme form, so that part was never a problem. So it's interesting. So a lot of issues were raised, like Stam Yenam and Yenesach. So they're not menasseh. They don't drink wine at all. What happens? If a Muslim touches your wine. So there it becomes usur only because you don't want to socialize, but not because of avodah zarah. That doesn't mean that there was a love going on. You have basically a tension that goes between the two groups. On the one hand, and what I want to close with, and there's a lot more we can say on this as well, probably there's no more admired Jew in the 12th century at the height of, at one of the heights of Muslim culture than the Rambam, Musa bin Maimun bin Abdullah. And he himself, who suffered under the Almohad persecutions, made his family leave Cordova and wander and perhaps pretend to be Islam. We don't know what went on with them. When he writes to Yemen, who there was an anti-Jewish persecution in Yemen in his day, he writes as follows: "Vatem achenu, yadu lachem shakadosh baruch hu hipilanu b'mahamurot avonotenu b'toch uma zo shehi umat Yishmael." שראתם חזקה עלינו, והם מתחכמים להרע ולמאוס אותנו כמו שגזר עלינו קדוש יתברך ואויבינו פלילים. ושלא תעמוד על ישראל אומה יותר אויבת ממנה ולא אומה שהיראה, it was more evil, more wicked, בתכלית הרעה לדלדל אותנו, להקדין אותנו ולמאוס אותנו כמוהם. Now, I tell often, when I see this, I often tell myself, if the Rambam really knew what the Christians were busy doing with the Crusades at the time, I don't think he would have been so chad mashmai. But this is where he was coming from. Now he may have been more extreme here in order to be able to make the Yemenites feel bad and to make them feel better and to strengthen them. But this is a pretty strong statement. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, you have the famous, and this is the text that everybody likes to quote, not the one I just quoted you. is a respondent that the Rambam wrote to Ovadia the convert. There were two people whose name was Ovadia the convert. I wouldn't be surprised if they both called themselves Ovadia because that was the Rambam's family name. One was a former Christian priest who came from southern Italy and moved to Eretz Israel and converted to Judaism, and in fact composed gorgeous Gregorian plain chant for the synagogue. I've only heard it performed once. It was in 1999 when they set up an exhibit on the occasion of the 900th anniversary of the conquest of Jerusalem by the Crusaders. There was a special exhibit at the Israel Museum, and in the exhibit hall, and you know, when you go in the straight, you go through the door, and the left is the special exhibits. So they piped this through the hall. It was really very cool. The other thing they showed at that exhibit was the Ramban's own signet ring, which they found near Haifa at the time, which was very, very, very nice. Anyway, so that was one. The other one was a former Muslim. How he managed to walk between the thing, we don't know. But we're talking here about the second one, whose name is also named Ovadia. Sheila, al elu yishma'ilim sha'amarta. You said, Ovadia, she'inam ovdei avodah zarah, that they're not idolaters. Va'amar lecha rabcha, she'im ovdei avodah zarah, v'havanim shemashlichim b'tarfutam heim amar kulis. There is one, I just mentioned, one of the things that they do in the context of the Hajj is to throw rocks at the Shaitun. Now, one of the things that, one of the forms of Avodah Zarah that the Mishnah and the Gemara discusses is throwing rocks at Markulis. Who's Markulis? Markulis is a corruption of Mercurius, Mercury. You know, the little guy who does the FTD florist? Mercurius. Mercurius, otherwise known as Pan, by the way. No, not Pan. Mercury was, I forget his Latin name. Mercury was the god of thieves and also the god of travelers. He's got the little wings in the corner. He's the messenger of the god. That's why he's FTD. He was also the protector of travelers, and there were little shrines along the way that people would pray at to protect them on there. It's like an ongoing Tfilas HaDerech. One of the signs of a shrine for Mercury was two rocks on the bottom and one on top. And what you would do is you would take a rock and put it there and go on. As time went on, they sort of like ended up like rocks at it, and that was, Chazal defined that as an avodah, which is indignified, but nevertheless a form of avodah zarah, and it's called Zorek Eved LeMarkulis. And here the Arabs are throwing rocks at the Shaitun. So this rabbi said that's what they're doing in, which shows that, by the way, that means that the average Jew knew something of what was going on during the Hajj. Anyways, so he says, Veshiv lechak shelo kahogan. He treated you very improperly. Ad shenitatzavta el libcha, till you were very upset. V'nichlamta v'karalecha anei ksil ki yivalto. So I'm telling you have to give it back to this rabbi who's an idiot. Tshuva. Elu ha-yishma'ilim einam ovdei avodah zarah ichlal. They do not worship avodah zarah, they are monotheists. Ukvar nichrita mipihem umilibam. Okay, there is no vestige of avodah zarah left with them, or polytheism, whatever you want to call it. V'hem miyachdim lakel yit'aleh. In other words, liyached meaning they attribute absolute oneness to God. Yichud ha-kara'uy, yichud she'en bo dofi. It's absolutely one undivided God. Shema Yisrael, Shem Elokeinu, Shem Echad. V'lo mipnei she'hem mishakrim aleinu. Okay, and it's not as if they were lying to us. U'mechazvim v'omrim she'anu omrim she'esh la'el yitaleb nichzav kach anachnu aleihem v'nomar she'em. It's not like with the Christians. They say God had a son, and we say they were their brothers. No. HaTorah he'id aleihem asher piyam divar shavi minam shaker. What?
What's the Torah? Sorry, when?
I mean, the Torah, the Torah says asher piyam divar shavi minam yamin shaker. He says the Torah already presumed, foresaw that. If you want to say that the Kaaba is a pagan temple, and there's a Avodah Zarah there, which, by the way, there was before Muhammad cleaned it up, right? I told you it was the central secretary of the pre-Islamic religion. Shayu avdim ota avotehem, ma bekach? Why do I care what they used to do? They have now abandoned polytheism. They're monotheists. Eilu mishtachavim kinegdo hayom ein libam ela lashamayim. Now, the use of this term is very important because the Gemara says that if you pray at a building and you think it's a shul, and it turns out it's an idolatrous temple, you're not guilty because libo lashamayim. Which, by the way, tells you that they used to design shuls and shuls according to normal. You know, you could make that mistake. Obviously, the architecture of shuls in the Talmudic period in some places was very similar to the idolatrous temples.
You couldn't
have, then you knew, right. Ukvar pershu razal b'sanhedrin shimishtachaveh adam lebeit avodah zarah. Here it is. V'usavur shebeit kneset halei libu v'asoy l'shamayim. V'chein, when the rabbi says v'chein in the Mishnah Torah, everywhere he says v'chein, that means the exact same way. Eilu ha'ishma'ilim hayom kulam. Taf and Hashem nechurta avodah zarah mipihem. V'tautam v'tibshutam b'dvarim acherim. He says, they, I'm not saying that they're not going to get him after Yonah. Then we're not giving him psichas nila. But their mistakes are elsewhere. She'iyev shalom ro b'chtab mipnei poshevi rishay Yisrael. I can't tell you what they are because they're a Muslim who are going to, so we'll just leave it at that. Aval, however, on the major point, b'yichud Hashem yitaleh, ein lahem ta'ut klal. U'be'emet, it's true. Shaya lishma'ilim mikodem ba'otama mekomot shlosha minei avodah zarah, peor, u'markulis, v'kemosh, and so on. But now, that's, it's gornish mid-gornish. And now, and at the fact, they skip down to the, in that paragraph to four lines up from the bottom. V'zeshen ha'shlicha avanim mifnei satan anu ha'shlichim otam kidei la'arbevo. Alright, they're throwing it to Satan to, in order to tumult the Satan. Again, the Rambam is being very careful. What do we do to confuse the Satan? We blow the second set, according to the Gemara, according to Tosfos, we blow the second, the Gemara, we blow the second set of shofar, of Kriyas Shofar to La David to Satan. So, his point is that this is a totally monotheistic religion. We have no problem with them. And then he says and goes on and on and says, your Rebbe was an idiot because you're a ger and you were in Torah and you have no right to, and onat varim is say, there's a chod masecha ha-rishonim and so on and so forth. But and here he's, and in the second half, it's, I mean, I read it on your own, is where he talks about the fact that a ger can say, Elokeinu ve'elokei avoteinu, Elokei Avraham, Elokei Yitzchak, Yaakov, and so on and so forth. So, the Jewish attitude towards Islam is on a continuum. From a purely halachic point of view, it is absolutely monotheism. It is absolutely, I remember once, telling a class that, there's no problem davening in a mosque. And they started screaming at me, how can you say you can't daven in a mosque? I said, and Marata Machpelah is, what? And the building of Shmuel Hanavi is what? And, I mean, what are you talking about? Oh, I mean, you get, people have these reactions. It's like I once mentioned to a bunch of, I was teaching a son at Touro and at Lander in New York, and I mentioned that once there were no books and everything was written by heart. What? The real swarm? What kind of course is that? I said, why do you think you call it Torah Shabbat Peh?
Yesterday I went to the camp.
Oh, that's another story.
In Ramla.
Yeah, because they're Anthony Cowrights in Jerusalem.
And it has a rug on it, and they take off their shoes.
Right.
Their shoe horns, it was so interesting, in the foyer before, you know, their entranceway, so they have these big shoe horns, you know, to get their shoes off or on, and, that, you know, they pray like the Muslims. I mean, I guess the Muslims learned it.
No, Cowrism arose in a Muslim orbit.
The idea of taking, they say because, you know, Hashem tells Moshe to take.
Right. Yeah. The Samaritans also like that. If you go to the shul in, you go to the synagogue in Har Gerizim, it's like that as well.
But you see how the connection between.
Look, I'm not saying, and that's important to keep in mind, I'm not saying that there were certainly cultural adoptions and, you know, there was influence. There's no question. I mean, look, Ashkenazic Jewish music is European and Eastern European. Arabic, Jewish, Mizrahi music is Arab. I mean, yeah, it's obviously, you know, and so, it's not, that's not, the question of influence, everybody's influenced. Okay? That's normal. But that's not enough to say, oh, it's all influence, is superficial at best. Some influences are, come in, you think that they're neutral, and then they end up having a lot of implications. So, for example, shalashudas. People used to eat twice a day, in the morning and the evening. The fact that usudash lishit was a special thing for Shabbos. We have lunch anyways. So shalashudas becomes this thing where you mix the tuna with the egg salad and you have a chila gasa, and there's some question as to how you've mekayim the mitzvah. Other things, the question of influence is not a question of whether there is influence. The question is, in general, outside influences do not enter into Jewish practice unless, A, there is a pre-existent need that has been generated by the Jewish community that something needs to find expression. B, and if something comes from the outside to fill that need, it is adapted to whatever Jewish norms there are, and often some kind of source is found inside to say, oh, this is something we always had, now we're just restoring it. And as important as things, as outside influence might be, it is just as important to see what was not accepted. This is an example which is, the idea that you need to, the idea of the various forms of penitence that you find in Sefer Hasidim, rolling around in the snow, stuff like that. Okay? So on the one hand, it's clear that the fact that these come forward and are developed and find echoes and find expression in Jewish literature, the fact that Christendom at the time was working with similar things is not a coincidence. On the other hand, the ways that forms of penance were developed, the modes, the things that Jews are supposed to do, the type of hierarchy of sins that are applied, and things which were not accepted from the outside world, that's all the difference. So in other words, so yes, the idea that you should have penance, you should bring upon yourself some kind of punishment which will atone for you, that may or may not be indigenous. The fact that you choose fasting or galut or something means that you look for something within your tradition which is going to fill that, you know, which is going to merge with it. The fact that Jews never found a way to cross them, I mean, that's a funny way to put it. Right. That kind of motions don't, whatever. On the contrary, sometimes we're the other way. We know, for example, that in the Middle Ages and before, Jews used to pray like this. But when, yes, and with their two hands together, and when there's a wonderful article by my colleague and friend, Professor Yitzchak Zimmer, in which he shows in manuscripts of Jews praying like this. Yes, I know in the yeshiva they used to say, go like this, because Christians... The article is in a book called Olam Keminhago Noheg, and the article is called Tikkunei HaTfilah, something like that. It's a yellow book, it's published by Merkaz Shazar. They stopped. No Jew davens like this anymore. By the way, Jews used to pray like this. What does it say? Yeah. But we don't do that anymore. How come? Because that's what the Muslims do. Nachon, bidyuk. We don't. The Muslims they pray like this. We don't do that anymore. Why? Because it's dafka. Because they co-opted something, became quintessentially non-Jewish, so we stopped doing it. In fact, one of the last vestige of that, actually, my late colleague and also friend, Professor Yisrael Tashma, who's at Chorna Livracha, once made the argument, and I think it makes a lot of sense. How come you cover your women cover their eyes when they bench licht? So the usual explanation is because there's this funny shita that you're not supposed to, if you light the candles already, then you'll have Mekabel Shabbos. It's based on one shita in the Rishonim. He argues no. He says that even though the mitzvah of Hadlakat Bat is really not a women's mitzvah per se, despite the Mishnah, the din is that the house should be illuminated, that's the point, but it was very early, became associated with women, and very early women turned it into their moment of personal spirituality. So, like everybody's bubby, you always about sitting with the Shabbos lift, with the Tzenu Rena, or with the Korban Mincha praying for all the children and the grandchildren and Shiduchim and whatever, So what apparently he argued people, women would do, would stand at the candles like this and pray. And it doesn't take a long way to go from this to this. So he thinks ultimately that the covering the eyes was rooted in standing before the candles and praying and offering a personal petition to God.
Covering your eyes
is probably comes from the this business about Kabbalah Shabbos, because there is this one sheet in the Rishonim, that of the Urayim, whose argument of when Shabbos begins was responsible for that. But he says, how do you get from this to this, of why the three times and why the use of the hands? He says he thinks it really comes from using parishchem kapechem, using the hands as part of the choreography of prayer. Well, I'm glad to finish with the Dvar Torah rather than whatever.
Thank you.
Correct.